Thanks for listening, and thanks, members, for supporting KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Art Focus with host Joseph Galavan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon College of Art and Crafts Studio School, offering classes and workshops for adults in book arts, ceramics, drawing, and painting, fibers, metals, photography, and wood. www.ocac.edu/register.
Andy Warhol is a shush scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol is a scream. Hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
I'm Joseph Galavan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Mary Beth Graybill. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. And she's here today to talk about samurai armor from the Anne and Gabriel Barbier Muller collection, which runs through January the 12th, 2014. Welcome, Mary Beth. It's lovely to have you here at KBOO.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
So, we need to know three things right off. What is a samurai? What's so different about their armor than, say, the Henry VIII stuff you can find in Windsor Castle? And who are Anne and Gabriel Barbier Muller?
Okay. I might take those in reverse order. Anne and Gabriel Barbier Muller are a couple in Dallas, Texas, who have been collecting Japanese armor for about 30 years now. And in that time, they have managed to amass one of the largest and most important collections of Japanese armor in private hands in the world. So it was their decision to make their collection available to the public. They began in Paris because the family has long time ties to Paris. That's where Gabrielle acquired many of the suits of armor from French dealers. And it's since gone to Quebec and Boston. Portland is the first West Coast venue. And to date, some 800,000 people saw the collection. Here we've had more than 12,000 come and see it while it's been on view. Mm-hmm. So that's the Barbier Mullers. And so the next... who are the samurai? Well, that isn't quite in reverse order, but anyway. The samurai, we have one sense of them that comes from popular culture, particularly Kurosawa's films, which are then picked up by George Lucas, you know, inspiring Darth Vader, but also in other forms of pop culture, Afro Samurai or Portland's own Dark Horse Comics. They're actually going to be at the museum this coming Saturday doing a program, Stan Sakai's very popular series, Usagi Yojimbo, sort of the rabbit bodyguard, which is both comics and anime and games. So there's a certain level in which the term samurai is now part of global culture. In Japan, it, of course, is a little bit more complicated, but to simplify it for a moment, we can say that samurai are the professional fighting men of Japan. The one nuance I would add is that sometimes samurai is not merely an occupation, it can be a class, in which case women and children are also members of the samurai class. But that would be true in the time of peace from 1615 onwards. But so if we think of Japan, the Japanese warrior, as the samurai, then the further nuance would be that it's the elite fighting men. We wouldn't use the word samurai for the average foot soldier running around in bare feet with armor he's scrabbled around, picked up. So it's men who take pride in their position and very often train from childhood in the arms. Mm-hmm. And then getting to the question of what makes Japanese armor different from classical European armor, if you think of armor at the Elizabethan court or Henry VIII's armor, our notion of knights in shining armor. The suit of armor in the West from the time of the Crusades forward tend to favor large, sheets of steel or iron plate. And it's, of course, articulated at the joints so that you can have movement. Our notion of a knight in armor being stuffed like a pincushion and unable to move is a little bit more mythological than real. But nevertheless, the forging the large sheets of plate, so a large sheet covering the chest, a large sheet for the back, and so on and so forth. And Japanese armor belongs to a kind of armor that we really find from Persia all the way to the Pacific Ocean, which is designed originally for equestrian archery. Because from prehistoric times, and in Japan until the 14th century, mounted archery was the most sophisticated form of warfare that you had. So the armor is classically made of small overlapping scales of iron, about the size of the tip of your finger, that are laced together in rows and then lacquered to make them waterproof. And then the rows are laced to each other so that what you get is in the lacing, which on the continent would be leather and on Japan very often is silk, which makes the armor very beautiful, you get an armor that is flexible and moves with the body. And unlike a single sheet of steel plate armor, it also is functions as a shock absorber. So this is armor that if you're hit with an arrow, and remember that's going to be a principal weapon, it creates an impenetrable mesh. So the arrows might stick, but they won't come through and hit you.
So it's like Kevlar.
Well, actually, prior to Kevlar, it really was one of the most effective kinds of armor there was out there. And so what you can see in the exhibition, I think it's a great, really fun exhibition for people who are interested in clothing and gear and in design, because you can see how armor then evolves in response to changing warfare, so that as we move away from an emphasis on a mounted cavalry shooting arrows at one another, and you begin to have massed infantry using bladed weapons, and especially something on the end of a pole, so a spear or a halberd or something like that, so that you can get a little bit of distance. The armor changes so that it's more close-fitting to the body, that it allows you more freedom of movement. And especially a big change in armor is they go towards using larger pieces of iron. Perhaps it would wrap the whole way around your front and then the whole way around your back in rows and lace that together so that you can make armor faster. In the early days, at the time of the rise of the samurai, 10th to 14th century, a commander's suit of armor could take 2 years to make. Mm-hmm. But when warfare becomes part of daily life in a century of civil war from the 1460s to the 1560s, and then you have another sort of 50 years of cleanup to unify the country, warfare is so much part of an adult man's life in the fighting classes. You had to have a suit of armor that you could make much more rapidly. So what's fun to see in the exhibition is how they make armor efficiently, this sort of quick production, but then they still want to make it beautiful, make it stand out so that an individual warrior can be noticed on the field.
And that means using colored silks and inlaid silver and things like that?
Right. So one of the ways that you allow yourself or make yourself be identifiable from a distance on the battlefield, exactly as you say, you would choose the colors of the silk lacings that you use in your armor so that you have a distinctive tone. You might lacquer the iron in your leather. There were entire clans that were known for lacquering, coating their armor with red lacquer so that they would go out on the field like this red wave. And that was a great source of family pride. But then the third way that you could be recognized, and this becomes very much the fashion, and I think we can actually use that word, in the second half of the second century, is kawari kabuto. It's a Japanese word that means a helmet which is bizarre or strange or extraordinary. And this is a new kind of helmet that has protecting the head is a small iron bowl. That's not particularly innovative. They've had that for centuries. But now what they're doing is they're putting this tall sculptural superstructure on top out of laminated paper. So you can think papier-mâché or softened leather that they have shaped you know, got it damp and shaped it on a wooden mold. And then they harden it with lacquer. And this allows you to have a hat in the shape of an eggplant or of a cresting wave or a dolphin or a scallop. And you really get the sense of individual samurai walking into an armor shop and saying, okay, I want a clamshell. I want a rabbit, you know, or something like that. So you get extraordinary individuality of expression, but also great creativity. And I think it's will be a surprise to people to think that that's a legacy of samurai culture. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that came about because of the peace of 1615, when people weren't going into battle as much, but they were still making armor. And what were they doing with that armor?
Well, the phenomenon that I was just describing of the extraordinary helmets, actually, that's the second half of the 16th century when you really want to be individually recognized on the battlefield, because it's a moment of such social mobility that an ambitious and able man could, and primarily one of the fastest ways to climb was through success as a warrior, could greatly change your social status in that period. But what happens in this series of civil wars in the second half of the 16th century is that Japan gradually is reunified. And you get the Tokugawa, it's a family of warriors, establishing a military dictatorship, and that's firmly in place by 1615. And so from that point on, warfare comes to an end because they rule with a rather iron hand, and people who had once been warlords now become provincial governors. Mm-hmm. And samurai are exhorted. They're required actually by law to pursue the martial arts as well as the civil arts. So a physical education class for young samurai would be archery and swordsmanship. But he's also studying the Confucian classics to learn how to be a good administrator. So you get these wonderful men of martial arts as well as the peaceful arts. Mm-hmm. But their social status is dependent on the fact that they're descended from people who are very good in the battlefield. So they continue, if they have any money, they continue to commission very fine suits of armor that are now become the way a suit of armor might be in 18th century Europe. You know, people aren't having jousting tournaments anymore, but a suit of armor speaks to your family prestige and lineage. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's actually where sometimes we most of the suits of armor that survive today and most of the suits of armor in the exhibition are from that era of peace. And they reflect both the concern with functionality, but now also very much with making a very handsome and beautiful suit of armor that speaks to your family's position.
So the families would have their own logo, right, and their own kind of brand, and you'd stick to that, or you might elaborate?
Well, if you were the families who had risen to be, let's say, the rank of provincial governor, growing out of the warlords of the earlier period, they would almost always choose a particular family crest, kind of at random. I mean, there wasn't any law, there wasn't any national board deciding who got which one, but you would choose a family crest, and then that becomes part of your family identity. So there are, in fact, several of the suits of armor and many of the helmets. The exhibition has 20 suits of armor and 46 helmets, plus horse armor and other kinds of battle gear. But many of them have these crests identifying the family from which they came. So you get you sort of larger identity within a lineage, but then the individual samurai's identity with his own personal taste in the designs he might choose to have, for example, incised into the iron on his armor.
Mm-hmm. And these are they the round images that's on the exhibition cards?
Yes, yes.
So they are kind of like logos.
Yes, they are very much like logos. It's an identifying mark for the family.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not pictorial necessarily.
Right,
yeah.
Right. They're not like heraldry. They're more abstract.
Right, yes.
You had a lecturer here on Sunday from the armories in Leeds. And
he
talked about the family that went with red and stuck with it. Who were they? What was the decision?
That was Tom Richardson from the Royal Armories in Leeds, and it was delightful to have him here. He was speaking of the E family, and they were vassals of Tokugawa Ieyasu, the man who emerged as the top hegemon in 1615. And they, what Tom was speaking of is that one of them, in the founding generation, mentioned that he happened to like red armor. He actually got permission from his lord, from his feudal lord, to wear red armor on the battlefield. And after that, for every generation, down until the samurai class comes to an end with a revolution and political change in Japan in 1868, through 20 generations, each successive head of the E clan and all of their highest retainers all lacquered their armor red.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, they were very distinctive for that.
Right. And just tell me what happened to the samurai in modern times. Do they just kind of fizzle out or do they go off into other endeavors?
Well, one of the fascinating things about samurai is Japanese history is unique in that it was actually governed by its military class for seven centuries, from the late 12th century down to the middle of the 19th century. And those were three successive dynasties, if you will, of shoguns. Shogun means barbarian subduing generalissimo, but functionally it means military dictator. So there's three hereditary families. But at the end of the samurai, the time that you're speaking of, in the 1860s, there it was samurai, lower-ranking samurai, who felt that the Tokugawa in Edo, which is Tokyo today, had become corrupt and weak. So they felt that it was time to overthrow them. But the only legitimate way that they could imagine doing that, being good Confucians and believing in loyalty and honor, was to restore the emperor, who had never been deposed. There had, all, throughout all these centuries of military rule, Japan has an emperor who is always, from a ceremonial, religious, ritual point of view, unquestioned in Japan, was to create a constitutional monarchy centered on the emperor. So they, samurai, have a revolution against the samurai and eliminate the samurai. within a few years, what had been for 2.5 centuries the samurai class's exclusive privilege of being allowed to carry two swords, that's abolished.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that anymore. Many samurai were upset about that, and you sort of have mini rebellions and one serious one. But for the most part, they abandoned their swords. But because this class had been for 250 years the best educated class, it's often from the samurai class that you get the leaders of the new government. So they would assiduously educate themselves in new, and that would be sort of be European or, well, it's American, you know, government politics. Samurai became leaders in business and industry. Quite a few men, not at the very absolute top level, but sort of secondary people who would have been captains of troops, went into the new armed forces, where they would find themselves doing something unthinkable in the previous times, which is they would be captains of a conscripted army. But they would have had the kind of training, the physical discipline and so forth that they could be very suited for military careers. So they go on really to kind of become the leaders of moving Japan into the modern industrialized world.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO Radio. My guest this week is Mary Beth Graybill. She's the curator of Asian art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's talking about samurai armor from the Anne and Gabriel Barbier-Muller collection, which runs at the museum through January the 12th, 2014. The collectors value the sculptural quality of these pieces. Could you just say a bit about that? Some of it is functional, such as the flaps around the helmets to keep arrows from behind getting to you. What are the other sculptural qualities that are valued by the art historian?
I think that when you look at the individual suits of armor, one, it's sort of speaking about, there are many sort of individual elements that are sculptural. If we look, the helmets themselves, the extraordinary helmets themselves are pieces of sculpture. The ornaments on the helmets, when you walk in and see the exhibition, the very first samurai that you'll see is mounted on a horse. And he has this magnificently sculpted dragon as an ornament on his helmet. So you will have decorative elements that are sculptural, but also you can think of the entire shape of the armor out of its sort of different parts, with the cuirass, the part that wraps around the torso, and the skirt, and looking at how the materials complement one another, and the almost abstract shapes that they make, but which have once held a body, you can see that as a sculptural form. And the other thing that the Barbier Müllers emphasize in their collection is extraordinary quality, high quality of craftsmanship. And what's, I think, so rewarding about this exhibition is when one stops to look very, very closely at a suit of armor, recognizing all the touches that the craftsman has put into tiny details that make an individual suit of armor truly a work of art, beyond going far beyond the requirements of function.
Mm-hmm. Things like the silk has been replaced over the years. That's part of the, you know, maintenance. But the basic metal base, you know, the pieces are probably original in all of them.
The suits of armor do date from quite a variety of periods. What will last the longest in a suit of armor is the iron, and there are a few helmets that are quite old that go back, I think, to the 13th or 14th century in the exhibition. And the helmet would be the one piece that might be handed down generation to generation. And in the museum's own suit of armor, for example, which we have lots of reasons to think is completed in about 1746, 47, from looking at it yesterday and various documents that have come with it, we're quite certain that the helmet and the mask were older pieces that the family had probably somehow acquired, and then they incorporate that into a new suit, which is created in the mid-18th century. So you can sometimes have iron parts that are passed down and reused. But as we looked at our own suit, it's quite clear that because all of the lacing is absolutely consistent and everything matches, that we're looking at laces, that our suit of armor has the laces that it was laced in 1747. And that's true of several of the Edo period, so 17th to 19th century, suits of armor in the Barbier Müller collection. On occasion, however, sometimes if a suit of armor was exposed to moisture or too much light and the silk was damaged, you might relace it. So it's a kind of repair, the way that you might fix your roof or redo your roof. And I think that people in the museum will be able to recognize the few suits of armor that have new, shall we say, within the last 50 years, lacing, because the lacing is so much more intense in color. But most of them are pretty close to the way they would have been assembled.
Mm-hmm. So you run the Asian galleries at the museum, and you've added on to this traveling show by using your galleries to support what's coming in. So what have you done?
Yes, thank you for bringing that up. We were very fortunate in the layout of our museum so that we were able to put the Samurai exhibition on the first floor, the first thing you see when you enter from both of our principal entrances. But those galleries are immediately adjacent to the Japanese galleries in the museum. So we took the time to create two displays that would complement or sort of be in conversation with the Barbier Müller collection. And one of these is a small display, Legendary Samurai, of 26 prints, Japanese woodblock prints, that are really illustrations of famous men in military history. And we wanted that to sort of satisfy the history buff, the person, the samurai fan who, you know, comes in and is looking for his favorite champion in samurai history. But also, I think that having the individual biographies there helps expand the notion about what samurai were like historically, not all alike. And then in our collections galleries, by drawing on the museum's collection as well as loans, we've put together art of the kind that samurai would have patronized, such as the tea ceremony, or the kind of luxury goods that would have been in a samurai woman's chambers, the kind of painting samurai would have shown in their reception halls, focusing on military valor. And then a very exceptional section of paintings by famous samurai painters of the 19th century. And what I like about those is, by fortuitous chance, the paintings are largely by men who knew each other, who were friends, companions, shared ideas, inspired one another. But they are so different in style, that they really speak to samurai as the intellectuals of Edo period Japan, the creators, the artists of Edo period Japan, but men who found art to be a form of individual creative expression. So I think that that emphasis on individuality reflects all the way back to those wonderful helmets where each man tried to create a distinctive personality, and suggests perhaps that that's one of the marvelous legacies of samurai culture.
Mm-hmm. And just to go back, the kind of social hierarchy was samurai at the top, then farmers or agricultural producers.
Right.
Then third was makers, so craftsmen.
Artisan and craftsmen, yeah. But also professionals. So this is, we're speaking about the Edo period when, yes, a kind of in this artificial and fairly rigid class hierarchy was established. And since the samurai made the rules, they put themselves at the top, yes. But they relied for their income on farmers producing particularly rice, mm-hmm. and the lands that they controlled. And the farmers paid tax in rice. Salary were paid their salaries in rice.
So who was paid?
The samurai, I'm sorry, were paid. Samurai were paid their salaries, right. in rice, not cash. So you would speak of a domain in terms of how many barrels of rice it produced in terms of its agricultural productivity. Mm-hmm. So that's why the peasants were valued, and that's also sort of a Confucian value. And then people who did something useful or made something useful. So armorers, but also physicians, poets, mm-hmm. writers. That's the third class. And merchants, because they didn't make anything useful, were at the bottom.
Merchants were at the bottom.
Merchants
Isn't that odd
bottom.
That now you have Larry Ellison at Oracle with his katana on his office wall.
Yes.
And all these, you know, moguls and Wall Street people who sort of fancy themselves as, you know, students of the art of war and things like that.
Yes, well, bankers would have been in the bottom in Edo period Japan, socially. But one of the interesting things about the Edo period is, as much as the samurai tried to hold society in a medieval pattern, in fact, it's one of the most creative periods in Japan in terms of urban growth and cities, and the merchants do rise to the top as the wealthiest class, often by lending money to samurai.
So just to give you a sense of what it looks like, a lot of these pieces look like the Native American collection, the kind of scary faces and tribal art. They have these face pieces that have bulging cheeks and noses. And in another way, they look like catchers in a baseball game, you know, the armor and the way they're kind of heavily protected. So it's a very striking, you know, if you just heard the word armor, you might, and didn't know what it was about. I'd recommend anyone go and see it, because visually it's quite amazing. I think very inspiring.
Thank you. I think that the variety and the visual, the colorfulness of Japanese armor does make it a treat for the eyes.
I'm Joseph Gallivan, and this is Art Focus on KBOO. This week, our guest was Mary Beth Graybill. She's the Arlene and Harold Schnitzer Curator of Asian Art at the Portland Art Museum. She was talking about samurai armor from the Anne and Gabriel Barbier-Muller collection, which runs at the museum through January the 12th, 2014. Thanks for coming in and talking to KBOO, Marybeth.
Thank you so much.
Next week, Ava Lake's guest will be Darren Orange. He's an artist from Astoria. Until then, good morning.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween Meltdown. Thursday, October 31st, 8 till 2:30 a.m., five bands with psychedelic 60s and 70s influences will play The Meltdown at the Bob White Theater in Portland. The bands featured are The Real, Cody and the Wheel, The Kingpins, Coca-Cola, and Mugspoon. They will be performing with the Vintage Oil Slides Psychedelic Light Show by Liquid Lights, Steve Goldsmith, and the Psychedelic Express. That's the Cascadia Psychedelic Revival Halloween Meltdown, October 31st, at the Bob White Theater at 6423 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. More information can be found at the KBOO.FM website. Click on the right side under Community Events Calendar.
Muertos Northwest invita al quinto anual celebración del Día de los Muertos, el sábado 2 de noviembre en Audio Cinema, desde la 1 de la tarde hasta la medianoche en 226 Sureste Calle Madison en Portland, debajo del puente Hawthorne. Celebrando la vida y la muerte, ayúdenos a traer los espíritus de tus queridos con su comida y bebida favorita. Y pues claro, bastante baile y alegría. Trae un artículo para agregar al altar comunitario. Habrá calaveras para decorar, artistas pintando caras al estilo muerto y también chocolatito y pan de muerto. Ven a escuchar el Mariachi Portland, Conjunto Alegre y Rafa de Alaska y su Deadliest Catch Band. Ven por los muertos y quédase a la comida, bebida y baile. Patrocinado en parte por KBOO, Tequila Cuervo y Cover Organ. Visita Facebook Muertos Northwest.